Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On board today, Jim McCormick, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Iowa State University. Jim, great to have you back.
Thank you very much, Ben. Happy to be here.
Chris Larimer with us as well, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Hi, Chris. Chris, we're waiting to hear from you. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, we hear you now. All right.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
All right. And we want to invite our listeners to join us on this Fun Drive edition of Politics Wednesday. A different number than if you'd like to pledge. Make sure you do pledge at ipr.org. But if you'd like to join our conversation, now that this rematch between Biden and Trump is set, what are your questions about the months to come before the election? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. A little later in the program, we'd like to hear from Chris and Jim about their expectations for tomorrow evening's State of the Union address by President Biden. Incidentally, you can hear the president's address and the Republican response beginning at 8 p.m. on IPR News. You can stream it as well at ipr.org. Also, we'll talk about Kyrsten Sinema announcing she's not seeking re-election. Of course, the Senate up for grabs and will be a big part of what happens in November. But first, let's get to Super Tuesday business. Former President Donald Trump, President Biden dominating yesterday's contests, with roughly a third of the delegates at stake that will determine the Republican and Democratic Party nominations. Trump's last remaining major Republican challenger, former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley, notched a win in Vermont. But the bigger news this morning, after a disappointing Tuesday result, she announced she would be ending her campaign for president. This morning, she did not give her endorsement to Donald Trump.
In all likelihood, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee when our party convention meets in July. I congratulate him and wish him well. I wish anyone well who would be America's president. Our country is too precious to let our differences divide us. I have always been a conservative Republican and always supported the Republican nominee. But on this question, as she did on so many others, Margaret Thatcher provided some good advice when she said, quote, never just follow the crowd. Always make up your own mind.
Nikki Haley dropping out of the race. The big question, who will Nikki Haley supporters vote for now? Chris Larimer, what's your take on Haley dropping out and where those supporters may go now?
Yeah, it's hard to know how much to make of, you know, that she didn't endorse Donald Trump last night. I think there's still time for that endorsement to happen. You know, we've seen in the past other Republicans come around to endorsing Donald Trump. You know, Mitch McConnell just today endorsed Donald Trump, someone who has had, you know, not the best relationship with Donald Trump. So I wonder if, you know, give a little bit of time from last night, that, you know, it would not be particularly surprising if Nikki Haley would end up endorsing Donald Trump. In terms of her supporters, I think that's, you know, as you said, that's kind of the big question that's out there. We know that some of her support is among Republicans who are frustrated with Donald Trump, do not agree with Donald Trump, do not approve of his behavior, of his statements. But whether or not those individuals would then support someone from the other side, I think that's a pretty big leap, right? We've talked before on the show about the pull of partisanship, and particularly among voters who are active in politics, how strong that pull is. To get someone to move to the other group, essentially, would be a pretty big ask. I think it's the real question is whether or not Donald Trump can mobilize those voters, mobilize the Haley supporters, so that they actually just turn out in November versus, I still think it would be unlikely that they would support Joe Biden.
Mm. Okay. Jim McCormick, your post-mortem on Nikki Haley's candidacy and the repercussions it will have in the coming months up until November.
I think Chris is right here that it does take some time for healing, I guess, you know, in terms of Nikki Haley coming to the support of Trump. But I think it's also incumbent upon Trump to actually reach out. I mean, even the statement that apparently he made this morning didn't seem like it was really going very far in terms of reaching out to those supporters, except to say to join the MAGA and group here. And I think that's problematic in terms of some of the Haley supporters. They have clear differences in terms of policy, for example, on foreign policy. Many of those are going to be much more supportive of support for Ukraine and so on. And I think also, you know, just the style, as Chris made mention. So it will be some time. But I also noted that in the clip you played, that she said that she's always supported the Republican nominee, even though she couched it then with that Margaret Thatcher quotation as well. So I think it's incumbent upon Trump. And I think it's a larger problem for Trump than for Biden. You know, Biden, you know, lost maybe 10 to 20% in many of these races last evening. And going back to, the Michigan, you know, he has to worry about bringing some of his progressive folks in. But I think the bigger problem is really for Trump, because you're talking about 30 to 40% of Haley supporters across all of these different primaries. And I think that's a very big problem. And what, Trump needs some of those supporters in order to win, and they can't just stay at home or go to third parties. So I think it's very incumbent upon Trump, if he really wants some of those supporters, to reach out to them and talk about their policy issues that they really care about, as well as, you know, if it's possible for Trump to talk about his particular style of behavior.
Yeah, as Chris noted, Jim, this morning, Mitch McConnell, the outgoing Republican Senate Minority Leader, endorsed Trump with these words: "It is abundantly clear that former President Trump has earned the requisite support of Republican voters to be our nominee for President of the United States. It should come as no surprise that as nominee, he will have my support." Contrast that with the quote, I guess this is from X, formerly Twitter, from Liz Cheney. She weighed in after Haley dropped out today, encouraged people to back her opposition super PAC. Her words: "The GOP has chosen. They will nominate a man who attempted to overturn an election and seize power. We have 8 months to save our republic and ensure Donald Trump is never anywhere near the Oval Office again." Of course, Liz Cheney, Jim, making that her stated goal for some time now. But we still have this divide in the Republican Party. And as you noted there, Jim, Donald Trump has to win back a sufficient number of people who may have misgivings about voting for him.
Yeah, I think that it's really a challenge. But I think also, at least I read into, and maybe I read too much into what Nikki Haley said, that she's not really going to run as a third party candidate. The question, and particularly if she has any aspirations of a national role in the future, you know, she doesn't really want to go that route. So, you know, trying to jump on what Liz Cheney said in terms of getting her supporters, I mean, the Liz Cheney statement, at least to me, suggests that, you know, jump on her bandwagon, you know, give her some financial support. Maybe we'll go a third route here. I don't think that's probably I can't read Nikki Haley's mind, but I think she wants to remain in national politics. And I think going a third route would be really problematic for her future in the, you know, in the Republican Party or whatever.
Yeah. Quickly before we go, Chris, this marks, you know, since the days of the Bush presidents and Reagan, such a change in the Republican Party. It's owned now by former President Trump, isn't it?
It sure seems like it, at least among, you know, active primary voters. That seems to be the preference.
Okay. When we come back, we'll have more analysis from Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, Jim McCormick, professor emeritus of political science at Iowa State University. You can join our conversation 1-866-780-9100 or river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Now that the rematch is set, what are your questions about the months before the general election? Back in just a moment with more of our Politics Day on River to River.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our analysts today, political scientists Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Dissecting those Super Tuesday results, also the announcement by Nikki Haley that she's suspending her election campaign. Let's go to Karen in Waterloo. Karen, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I think, and I'm curious about what your experts think with regard to Nikki Haley declaring independently. I wonder what if she actually won, and I know she's more moderate. I know a lot of people, I changed parties so I could caucus for her, and actually she won in my precinct over, you know, it wasn't, in either case, I'm curious as to what the House and Senate would start to look like. Would they start to work with each other if they don't have a president that's fighting, you know, the opposite party? Just curious.
Yeah, so if your question is if Nikki Haley had succeeded, which she hasn't, I mean, it would have, Chris Larimer, it would have meant that we have an entirely different Republican Party.
Well, she didn't endorse anyone.
Right.
She didn't endorse anyone, so we don't know that she won't declare independently.
Okay,
I think
very
she's
good.
Just far enough out there. She said in her speech last night, don't follow the crowd. So,
right.
You know, I think that there's every possibility that she might.
Okay. Karen in Waterloo. Jim, what do you think about Karen's thoughts there?
Well, as I was saying before, I think that, you know, if Nikki Haley has some aspirations for future national office, I think it would be difficult for her to really succeed, you know, with a third party and then try to come back and get one of the major party nominations. So I actually don't think that she'll pursue that route, because I think she still wants to, as she started out by saying, I'm a conservative Republican, so she probably wants to stay in the party. And I think if she did run, of course, she would, I think, really take obviously lots of votes away from Trump and ensure that Biden is president, and she said that she doesn't support that either. So I'm skeptical that she would follow the third party route.
Mm-hmm. You as well, Chris?
Yeah, I am. I think, you know, I agree with Jim. I mean, I think, you know, there are kind of two extremes here. Would she go the third party route and run as an independent, or does she come around and end up endorsing Donald Trump and actively seek to be his vice presidential nominee? I mean, that's kind of the extremes of where we are. And I agree with Jim. I don't think she'd go that route. But I was also, you know, thinking back to your question right before break about the differences between or within the Republican Party over time, going back to Reagan, to George H.W. Bush, even to George W. Bush. I mean, it was just over three years ago where that video came out following the 2020 election, where Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush got together to talk about, you know, the need to come together as a country following the 2020 election and so forth. Going forward, maybe something to watch will just be, you know, the Republicans who maybe were associated with the George W. Bush campaign or his presidency, do we see any of them coming around to endorse Donald Trump, or do they kind of stay away and just see how this unfolds?
Yeah. Let's listen to former President Donald Trump after this big Super Tuesday primary win, looking to his likely matchup against President Biden, speaking to supporters at Mar-a-Lago after the Tuesday wins.
We've watched our country take a great beating over the last 3 years, and nobody thought a thing like this would be possible. We wouldn't have Russia attacking Ukraine. We wouldn't have Israel being attacked. Iran, as you know, was broke when I was running things. They were broke. They didn't have money for Hamas. They didn't have money for Hezbollah. We had no inflation. Inflation is destroying the middle class. It's destroying everything. Inflation, if you look back over the history, hundreds of years back, it's called inflation. It's called a country buster. And that's what it's doing to our country. What's happened with inflation has been unbelievable. A lot of people say, a lot of experts have said, the stock market's the only thing that's doing well, and that's doing well because our poll numbers are so much higher than Joe Biden's.
Former President Trump speaking in typical hyperbole, tapping, though, Chris, into some real sentiment there. We always have to say, you know, Trump likes to exaggerate, is known for lying, but he's tapping into sentiments that Republicans and others have, according to our polls, isn't he?
He is, in terms of just sort of general feelings about the direction of the country, as well as general feelings about the state of the economy and how, you know, the level of economic anxiety there is among voters out there. And you're right, that's what we continue to see in polls pretty consistently, is that voters seem to give Donald Trump slightly higher marks than Joe Biden on the economy, see him as, you know, a more able leader, I guess. And we know from, you know, past presidential elections that, you know, some of those, the so-called swing voters or more independent voters, you know, they're going to be looking at, you know, their own financial conditions. They're looking at things like food prices, gas prices, things that directly affect them economically or financially. And that can move them maybe one way or the other. And so he's really talking about those general election themes in that speech last night, really talking about trying to create that or present that contrast between his what he feels his administration did versus the Biden administration, but really talking about in terms of general election narratives.
Yeah, and the narrative from the Biden team, Jim McCormick, couldn't be different. And we can dovetail into the State of the Union address. We expect him to address, highlight the bipartisan infrastructure law, that bipartisan CHIPS law that invested millions of dollars in manufacturing semiconductors domestically, his efforts to get rid of junk fees, the Inflation Reduction Act, provisions to lower prescription drug costs. There's a long list. By any measure, Jim McCormick, Biden has made major accomplishments in his first term, hasn't he?
Yes, he has. I mean, some of these bills, as you know, that the litany that you laid out there, the Inflation Reduction Act and CHIPS and so on, and the infrastructure bill is obviously very consequential. I think part of the problem, and indirectly, it seems to me, Chris was alluding to this, they have not really sort of seeped down among individual voters here. A lot of those are kind of aggregate successes. The unemployment rate in general is low. Inflation has been tamped down, but there's also inflation already sort of in the system as well, baked into, you know, prices and so on. And so that difference between what I would say is sort of the aggregate successes that Biden has and individual successes of people in the country, you know, that's where the gap is, and that's where the difficulty is that he really has to address. I think one other issue that he'll really address tomorrow night, if we can just segue into that, is he's going to talk about democracy. He's going to talk about democracy and the challenge to democracy that the Trump administration would portend. I don't know if he'll mention specifically January 6th, but he'll certainly make allusions to it as well as one of his successes in terms of trying to restore law and order. I think his Achilles heel, and we ought to talk about it, that he'll have to address in that talk too, is immigration. And, you know, he's probably going to come out and simply blame the Republicans, you know, on the immigration issue. But I think that's the kind of, you know, successes he's got to talk about, but he's also got to talk about the challenges to democracy, the challenges on immigration. And I'll be interested to see if he says anything about crime, because You know, that's also, that's has kind of dovetailed lately with immigration and crime have kind of dovetailed together here. So those are some of the substantive kind of issues that I would see in the State of the Union. One other thing I think he has to start out with and maybe throughout the speech is the style of his presentation. No hiccups, no mistakes, in terms of his delivery here.
Yeah, and we could see, Jim, and before we get Chris's view on this, we could see in the House chamber there, we've seen it in recent State yes. of the Union addresses with other presidents, some combativeness, some voices from the chamber. Jim, do you expect that? Yes. I mean, he'll have to be on his toes, won't he?
Yeah, I would expect some of that, although presumably be interesting if Speaker Johnson, sort of keep his troops in line here in terms of the given the event itself here.
Mm-hmm. Chris, your view of tomorrow night's State of the Union, you can hear that presidential address. Also, the Republican response beginning at 8 p.m. on IPR News or streamed over IPR.org. Chris.
Yeah, I agree with Jim. I think, a big part of the speech is going to be, credit taking. And for exactly the reasons Jim laid out, my colleague Donna Hoffman and her co-author Allison Howard have literally written the book on State of the Union speeches. And that's a big part of it. And Jim's right that he needs to use that speech to credit take in a way that does connect all the way down to the individual, right? Because Jim talked about that gap between those aggregate level measures and the individual feelings on the economy. So you're right, he's going to talk about infrastructure projects, but he's probably going to mention specific infrastructure projects in specific states, right? In battleground states, to try to make that connection on a very individual level. I think, he's as Jim said, it also does need to be kind of a dynamic speech. I mean, one of the things, if there's one word that's sort of among others, but maybe one word that's kind of dominated the election so far, it's been the word age. So how does he, does he deliver a speech in a way that's dynamic enough to try to sort of offset some of the current concerns that we've seen in polls? And then, as Jim said, immigration, that's kind of those age and immigration seem to be the two key words right now defining this election. Does he talk about it in a way where he tries to present a more moderate, or if not even maybe right-leaning proposal on this? I think Jim's right. He's going to talk about the proposal that was out there, but then ultimately rejected by House Republicans and Senate Republicans. But I think, you'd expect him to take a pretty moderate stance on immigration, but certainly talking about it.
Yeah. Teresa from Ames weighs in here via email. Jim, I think it references something you said. You said, of course, talking about democracy will be something the president will emphasize during the State of the Union. Teresa from Ames says, please stop talking about Trump like he's any ordinary candidate. He is not. He's running to stay out of jail, hijack our democracy, and retain power indefinitely. Jim, we have indications from Trump's own words about what's in store there. Do we have, what can you say to Teresa, who says, we need to stop saying that Trump is an ordinary candidate? We know he is not. But answer Teresa's concerns there.
Well, I mean, there's 91 charges against Trump, right? I mean, felony charges here, and he's got four or five different, well, maybe six different trials going on. So, in that sense, he's obviously not an ordinary candidate. But, I guess the response is that he's won all these votes across all these states, in all these primaries. And the Republicans are about to nominate him as their, by next summer, by in July, they're going to nominate him as a Republican nominee. So, that is also part of the Democratic system that, that he's following through on that. We'll see what happens in terms of all of these cases. Maybe he will be disqualified, if one of the cases calls for jail time or something like that before the election. I suppose that could have a, upended effect on things. But, at this juncture, at least in terms of seeking the nomination, as far as I can tell, he's pretty much played by the rules of the game so far.
Yeah. Chris, back to your comments about President Biden's age posing a deepening threat to his reelection bid. We have in this New York Times Siena College poll that Those who supported him in 2020 now say he's too old to lead the country. And when we come back, I'd like to get your views on age. You know, Donald Trump is just 4 years younger than Biden, and yet polls showing a real difference there in the age and the effectiveness they may have in a term as president. We'll be back in just a moment with more of our political analysis from Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with more of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News, I'm Ben Kiefer, with our political scientists Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Join us 1-866-780-9100, dissecting Super Tuesday and more. And I want to have Jim and Chris pick out so many new poll findings, not only the New York Times and Siena College polling, but also the various Iowa polls from the Des Moines Register, Mediacom, coming out over the last few days. Have them pick out a few things of interest to them that they see in this poll, at latest polling. But let's go to Malcolm, first of all, in Cedar Rapids. Malcolm, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
So my question really in lies with the recovery of our democracy after the election. And what I mean by that is I don't really see an upside to either winning. If President Biden was to win and the Republican Party, or rather the Trump supporters, were to question the validity of the election again, where does that leave us? And vice versa, considering how polarizing the ex-president is and the pending lawsuits against him, who's to say that, you know, he can't change some nature of litigation to be in his favor so that he can, you know, absolve himself of any crime that he does? So just a question I wanted them to tackle.
Okay, either way, Malcolm has concerns there. Chris, how do you respond to Malcolm there, who sees either way our democracy is not coming out a winner?
Well, I mean, it's a good question in the sense of trying to figure out, you know, if the electorate, the active electorate, is as polarized as all the polls suggest, it, you know, no matter what happens, there's going to be, you know, a sizable portion of the electorate that is going to be extremely frustrated by the result. And, you know, whether or not we can sort of come together after that, I think, is a real question. I mean, we see polarization in Congress. We see polarization in state legislatures where it's incredibly difficult for the two sides to come together on anything. And so I think, you know, to some extent, what Malcolm's getting at is, you know, after the election, whoever wins, do we see the two sides coming together to produce big policy change, or do we continue to see gridlock? Do we continue to see very polarizing rhetoric? And I think it's at the moment right now, it's hard to see a way out of that, because it just seems to continue with every election cycle, and it continues with every conversation that's over these really big issues.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, I guess to dovetail onto Malcolm's comment there, should former President Trump not win election, does that put an end to the Trump movement? What happens to the Trump movement after that? Does it continue?
I actually don't think it will continue, because there will be the call within the party for new leadership and new directions. Because keep in mind that, you know, the Trump folks have lost in 2018, 2020, 2022. And so, you know, even though in 2022, you know, it's supposed to be this red wave and all of this sort of thing. So, you know, that's going to be very devastating for the MAGA Republicans. And there's going to be a great call within the party, it seems to me, to move in a different direction to get different leadership here. And to get back to Malcolm's questions, one of the things that has to occur, I think one of two things has to occur in terms of, you know, sort of at least beginning to move in the direction away from this extreme polarization. First of all, probably we have to have where the Congress is not so evenly divided. I mean, a two-house majority and a two-seat majority in the House and, you know, one-seat majority in the Senate, you know, is just a recipe for gridlock. So in some senses, it would be useful. I'm not suggesting which party, but, you know, that one party or the other has a more commanding lead in terms of trying to get their programs established here. The other thing is political leadership. You know, one of the things that is a little bit disappointing about the, you know, Biden administration is that when Joe Biden was running for president, he was going to say he was going to unify the country here. I think what we really need is a leader that actually believes that and actually will work to undertake that and to create a political culture. I mean, you know, at the base of democracy, as you know, this is sort of, you know, 101, is that the political culture must be willing to accept defeat as well as victory. You know, mm-hmm. that's the essence of democracy. And that has to come from the top and from the leadership. You know, you can't have constantly, you know, challenging in court all of the decisions that are made, you know, in terms of the ballot box and that sort of thing. So it really does require leadership from the top and really, I suppose, at all levels, but also to educate the public that political culture involves waiting for the next election if you're not satisfied with the outcome that has just been rendered here. So that's, I think, part of the answer to Malcolm's question. It's an overtime phenomenon. It's not a single shot, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left of our program. I'd like to get your reaction to a couple of things away from Super Tuesday, Jim and Chris. Chris, to you first on this. Yesterday, independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema announced she will not run for re-election this year. She leaves the Senate after one term that saw her paint Arizona blue. She left the Democratic Party during her term. She played a key role in numerous legislative negotiations in a highly divided Senate. Here's part of what she had to say in announcing that she will not run again.
Despite modernizing our infrastructure, ensuring clean water, delivering good jobs and safer communities, Americans still choose to retreat farther to their partisan corners. These solutions are considered failures, either because they're too much or not nearly enough. It's all or nothing. The outcome, less important than beating the other guy. The only political victories that matter these days are symbolic. Attacking your opponents on cable news or social media. Compromise is a dirty word. We've arrived at that crossroad, and we chose anger and division. I believe in my approach. But it's not what America wants right now.
With Kyrsten Sinema not seeking re-election as an independent, it leaves the Republican, the 2022 gubernatorial candidate, Carrie Lake in Arizona, incidentally a graduate of the University of Iowa. Also the leading Democrat, Representative Ruben Gallego, running hard to replace Sinema. Chris, what do you make of Sinema's decision, her words there, and the impact of her not to seek that re-election bid?
Well, I think the impact is, you know, obviously it immediately focuses on Arizona, how competitive that race is going to be, what that means for, you know, the balance of control in the United States Senate chamber. I mean, it's incredibly significant. I think you're going to see a lot of money, a lot of attention on that race. I think, you know, the other side of it, as far as her words, her statement, and the decision not to run, it reflects what we've heard from candidates over the last few years who decide to step away, is that the Congress has become too polarized, that they are, you know, it's a legislature that it just becomes incredibly difficult to work across the aisle, that they're not getting done what they want to get done. And that seems to be one of the primary reasons candidates who retire earlier than expected cite as their reason for retirement. Now, you know, you have to be kind of careful with that, in that, you know, there's research also to suggest that folks retire because their next election is going to be more competitive than expected, or going to be a particularly competitive and expensive race. But the polarization part of it is something that we hear candidates continue to cite as a reason for not running for for re-election. And so, you know, now we've talked about polarization in terms of the lawmaking process, but it also bleeds over into just even decisions to run for office or decisions to run for re-election.
Yeah. Chris, I want to end up with Jim, but Chris, we're running out of time. We had a series of Iowa polls come out in the last few days. One in particular, we don't have much time, but pick out one or two aspects that interest you most as a political scientist.
Well, I think that, you know, what we see in the Iowa poll seems to reflect what we saw, what we see in the New York Times Siena poll, in that, you know, the President Biden's favorability ratings are down considerably in Iowa, down nationally. The gap between Biden and Trump in Iowa is even larger than what it is nationally. And that we mentioned that issue of age, and you see that same thing in the Iowa poll, where Iowans seem to be less concerned about age from Donald Trump than they are about Joe Biden, even though, as you said, there's just a four-year gap between 81 and 77. So I think, you know, what we see in Iowa seems to match nationally, that Iowans are frustrated by the direction of the country. They disapprove of Joe Biden more so than Donald Trump, but really there's disapproval across both candidates. And so I think, again, I think it just suggests that this is going to be a very polarizing election.
Yeah. Joe Biden sees continuing decline in his favorability ratings in this Iowa poll. Donald Trump gets a sizable jump. Jim, what do you make of that? You go back decades in your political analysis. Unlike in many election cycles in the past, Iowa not considered a battleground state. Well, Iowa's gone from purple to solidly red here, and even more so in these latest poll numbers.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the disapproval rating for, I'm just looking at the results here, for Biden is at 69% and only a 29% approval rating. I mean, I think the state has moved very much to the right. And, you know, we see that in terms of the Iowa legislature as well, that there is just an embrace, really, of some of this MAGA principles here. And we see it even some of the bills that are that are circulating in the state house at the present time here. So the part of the issue is, I suppose, the Republicans have done a better job at organizing and operating throughout the state. I mean, one of the things that the Democratic Party has been concerned about is that how well organized and how campaign efficient they have been. And I think that also portends that. But I think there is just a social conservatism that permeates the state of Iowa as well.
Yeah, you mentioned that the Democrats, of course, according to unofficial results posted yesterday afternoon, President Biden won Iowa's first ever mail-in Democratic presidential caucus, 91% of the vote selecting his name. The Iowa Democrats chose to say they were uncommitted in 4% of those results there. Chris, is this the end of an era for Iowa Democrats? The caucuses, we're just getting these results of those first ever mail-in ballots.
I think we've talked about this before, but I think it 2028 is going to be a difficult path to get the first of the nation back. Now, with that said, it seemed to be that the mail-in process worked as it was intended to work. The total number of mail-in ballots this year, as I've read, is on par with what we saw in 2012, the last time there was a Democratic incumbent running. So the numbers are roughly the same, I think, and the process seemed to work generally. But again, I think it's trying to have Iowa be first in the nation again in 2028, I think is probably still going to be a challenge for the Iowa Democratic Party, given the changes that were made this last year.
Jim, in the final minute or two here, I'll have you comment on the Middle East. Of course, that's having implications for our general election here. This morning, Hamas said it will continue to negotiate through mediators toward a ceasefire deal. Talks underway in Egypt. Yesterday, an Israeli government spokesman telling reporters that Israel has put its cards on the table, expressing hope for an agreement. What do you see as the outlook for a ceasefire deal?
Well, you know, the Biden administration has talked about having a ceasefire by Ramadan, which is beginning next Monday here. And I think that's probably still the targeting that they're engaged in. there's been a lot of pressure put on, I mean, with the vice president rather than the president meeting with Benny Glantz on Monday in Washington, much to the chagrin of the Israeli prime minister here. So there clearly is much more pressure being put on the Israelis by the American government here. You know, the vice president on Sunday called for an immediate ceasefire. And I noticed that as President Biden was outside the White House yesterday, he also made mention that there really must be a ceasefire here. So maybe we're moving in that direction, but the situation in Gaza is really grim. I mean, with the number of people that apparently are near starvation or starving, and the number of deaths that had already occurred.
Indeed. Jim McCormick, thank you very much. Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Iowa State University. Chris Larimer, Professor of Political Science at UNI, thank you both so much for your insights.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
Today's program produced by Danny Geer with help from Maddie Willis, Steve Cooper, and Nick Briggs. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.